Hello, and welcome to Specimen Stories. My name is Clara Nordén. In this podcast, I explore some of the amazing and surprising science that emerge from natural history collections. If you've visited a natural history museum, you've probably been astonished by the displays of animals and fossils in the exhibitions. But these displayed specimens form only a small fraction of the total collections contained in a natural history museum. Large museums, such as the Smithsonian, have millions of specimens in their collections that are not on display, ranging from jars with preserved fish to taxidermy birds and fossil dinosaur bones. These collections form a record of the diversity of life on Earth and are an invaluable resource for scientists. But what exactly can we learn from natural history collections? What stories do the specimens tell us? In this series, we meet the scientists working with specimens and learn about the scientific discoveries they made working in the collections. Join me in exploring the hidden world of specimens. Leaves are turning vibrant red and yellow. The air is chilly and fresh. It is clear that fall has arrived. If you want to avoid freezing temperatures, this is a time to be on the move. Millions of birds migrate south every fall. Where I am, on the east coast of the United States, a remarkable animal is on the move right now. Its wings are bright orange with black markings and it has a delicate fluttering flight. It's not a bird, it's a butterfly. The monarch butterflies migrate over 2,000 kilometers every fall to reach their wintering grounds in Mexico. It's an astonishing journey for an insect. But not all monarchs migrate. Some populations stay cozy and warm year-round on tropical islands in the Pacific Ocean. How did these monarchs end up there? And how did they lose their ability to migrate? Micah Friedman, who's currently a postdoctoral researcher at the University of Chicago, realized that museum collections of monarchs could give us unique insights into these questions. In this episode, I talked to Micah about his research on monarchs, why they migrate, and how and why some monarchs lost migration altogether. Welcome to Specimen Stories, Micah. It's great to have you on the show.
I'm happy to be here.
So, Micah, I think a good place to start is perhaps to introduce the monarch butterflies for those of us who have never heard of them. So, for many North Americans, the monarch butterfly is extremely familiar. Perhaps you've seen this butterfly in your backyard. But for other people, especially if you're not living in the North Americas, you may have never heard of it. So who are the monarch butterflies?
Sure. So monarch butterflies, they are members of a genus called Danaus, which are milkweed butterflies. The thing that they're probably best known for is their migration biology. And the thing that is really incredible about monarch butterflies is that even though they only weigh about half a gram, they can complete this massive migration where individuals can fly on the order of about 4,000 kilometers in their lifetime. And so the way that it works is they, in the fall, they will key in on environmental cues, things like the day length getting shorter, the nighttime temperatures and the daytime temperatures also getting cooler, and the plants that they feed on as caterpillars starting to deteriorate in quality. And all of those signal to them that it's time to go. And those caterpillars will develop into what's sometimes called the super generation of butterflies. And those monarchs will make oftentimes an uninterrupted, meaning like they'll stop for nectar and to drink water, but those individual butterflies can basically traverse the entire North American continent and fly from as far north as areas in Canada all the way to central Mexico, where they then spend the winter in a state sort of like hibernation. They're in reproductive dormancy. And then when the days start getting longer again, they will turn around fly northward and in sort of a stepwise process over the course of a few generations, four or five, they will recolonize North America and they make it back up to the northern parts of their range, usually by June or July of the following year.
Wow, I mean, that's an incredible journey for any animal to make. And to think that it's these tiny insects that travel hundreds of miles is just absolutely insane. And it's not particularly common for butterflies, right, to do this. So could you explain to us why the butterflies need to make this epic journey? Why is it necessary for them to travel from the northern part of North America all the way down to Mexico? Is it too cold, perhaps, in North America during the winter?
Yeah. So, yes, like you were saying, monarchs themselves are not freeze tolerant. So there are some, like butterflies and moths, that can overwinter in areas that get below freezing. But usually they will do that either as eggs or caterpillars or as pupae. Monarchs, if they experience temperatures below freezing for more than a few hours, it's lethal to them. So they have to position themselves in space so as to not experience prolonged freezing temperatures. And then, yeah, I mean, fundamentally, I think all of these butterfly migrations really are about tracking resource pulses. And so for the monarchs, their host plants are milkweeds, mostly in the genus Asclepias. And after the end of the last glaciation period within North America, those milkweed host plants also kind of expanded their range into temperate areas of North America. And those have become sort of the most productive summer breeding ground for monarch butterflies.
Right. So the ancestors of monarchs really lived in these tropical, warm and nice places. And then when their food, the milkweed, started to move to temperate ranges, some of the monarchs came with them. But of course, once they moved to temperate ranges, they had to deal with this terrible thing called winter. And for the monarchs, the solution to that was to migrate each winter. So they migrate from the north down to Mexico to stay warm because they're not really adapted for cold temperatures at all.
Right.
But another thing that's so fascinating with their migrations is that they don't just go to any place in Mexico. They have to go to these really particular places to overwinter, these particular kind of roosting sites, right?
Right. As you were alluding to, the fact that they're able to make it back to this incredibly specific area within Mexico, like their overwintering grounds within Mexico, the area that they cover is really small. It's only like a few hundred acres. And so the whole, you know, like idea that these butterflies, the ones that actually fly to Mexico, they have never been there themselves. And it was their great-grandparents or their great-great-grandparents that were last in those locations. And that's, I think, maybe the most fascinating thing about their biology. And it's still kind of an unanswered question, is how they're able to get back to that extremely specific and extremely sort of climatically favorable location for them.
Yeah, so that's actually one of the things I didn't realize before either, that it's not really the same butterflies that travel back and forth between North America and Mexico, but it's a multi-generational migration. So the butterflies that are flying down to Mexico now have actually never been to these places before, and we really don't know how they find these places. But we do know that they reach these wintering sites in Mexico in about early November, late October. Is that about right?
Yeah. Around early November or the very end of October is when the first ones will start to reach the overwintering sites in Mexico. Like, one of the things that's maybe kind of like cool and iconic about their arrival in Mexico is that it coincides with the like Day of the Dead ceremonies, and they are this very sort of important cultural symbol. And yeah, for some of the people in Mexico, they think of the monarchs as like the sort of the return of kind of like the spirits or like their ancestors. And so there's a lot of the like Day of the Dead imagery involves like colors or like depictions of monarch butterflies.
Yeah, that's really cool. And on the other hand, maybe not surprising that this natural spectacle would have inspired, you know, a lot of cultural influences as well, because it's not only scientists, but also the public take a lot of interest in these migrations. But I wonder, Micah, for you, what was it that inspired you to work on monarch migrations? Did you have early experiences of watching their migrations as well? Or how did you get interested in studying these insects?
So my path to studying monarch butterflies began in, of all places, Guam, which is an island in the Mariana Islands, really isolated in the middle of the Pacific Ocean. And this was the year after I had graduated from college. I was working on a project in Guam called the Ecology of Bird Loss Project. So was there for a year. And on the weekends, one of the people who I worked with there, we would sometimes go out to local spots to, you know, enjoy the natural history. And she mentioned at one point, like, oh, we should go check out this spot where there are monarch butterflies. And I was like, excuse me, what are you talking about? This is like, you know where we are. We're, you know, 6,000 kilometers from Hawaii and 3,000 kilometers from the Philippines. Like, surely there aren't monarch butterflies here. But then, yeah, sure enough, we went to the spot the next day and there are tons of monarch butterflies flying around. And that sort of set me on this path of trying to figure out, what are monarch butterflies doing here on this tiny rock in the middle of the Pacific Ocean? How did they get here? When did they get here? And sort of what's going on? How is their ecology different than their North American relatives?
Right. So you actually came to Guam studying birds originally, and then you left being interested in monarch butterflies, right? But it's a great question, though. What are these monarch butterflies doing on this little island in the middle of the Pacific Ocean?
Yeah, so sort of as I did more reading, realized they're not just in Guam. They're on basically every single Pacific island. They've also expanded their range and crossed the Atlantic, so you can find them as far east as like Spain and Portugal and Morocco. And then they also expanded their range into Central and South America and the Caribbean. And in pretty much all of these places where they have become established, they are non-migratory. And so the plants that they feed on, the milkweed that they eat as caterpillars, grows year-round in most of these places. And they seem to have just sort of given up on seasonal migration, because why bother? Like, your plants are there. There's really no reason to. And so that's sort of the roundabout way that I came to start thinking about monarch migration, as sort of in this comparative way, like thinking about all of these populations that no longer migrate.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting, because we're so used to thinking about monarch butterflies as migrating that it's kind of strange to imagine that some of them have lost this ability, and yet that is true for many populations, such as the one at Guam, where they don't need to migrate anymore. And of course, it raises the question of how that evolved, how these butterflies changed from their North American ancestors that did migrate. And also, natural history collections can actually be a really great tool to answer that question, right? So, Micah, tell us how you proceeded to take your next step in answering this question, and how natural history collections actually played a role in that.
Sure. So I guess one of the very first questions that kind of came to mind when I started thinking about these non-migratory butterfly populations, I should mention right now, a lot of this research that I did, especially early on, was with a collaborator named Hugh Dingle, who's a professor at UC Davis, who's most of his career has been studying animal migration. And so we made a return trip to Guam during my first year of graduate school to collect some of the butterflies there. And while we were there, we had the idea of going into a natural history collection at the University of Guam, and we wanted to compare monarch butterflies that had been collected in the past to monarch butterflies that we found there in the present. And part of the reason we were interested in doing that is we just wanted to know how much have these butterflies changed compared to their migratory ancestors in North America since they arrived here. And so...
And maybe we should just... When did they actually arrive there?
Yeah, so it's... we don't know precisely, and that I guess that's sort of a general theme for a lot of their establishment locations, but the first records that show up in museum collections are for Guam, 1887, I believe. So about 130 years ago.
So pretty recent.
Yeah. So it sounds like a long time ago, and it corresponds to a lot of monarch generations, but this isn't, they almost certainly haven't been there for like thousands or tens of thousands of years.
Right. So that's pretty cool. You could go to these collections and create kind of a time series of what the monarch butterflies looked like, the very first ones that came to Guam back in the late 1800s, all the way up to present day, the ones that you were collecting in Guam in the field.
Yeah. Well, so that was the idea, and that's what we wanted to test. And the collection at the University of Guam wasn't huge. It had maybe 50 monarchs in it. And the earliest ones that we could find in that collection only went back to the 1950s. So there was a hint, but it felt a little bit unsatisfying, like knowing that there are older specimens out there. So what started at the University of Guam was this, I started compiling this data set it would go into museum collections, photograph the butterflies, the monarch butterflies in those collections. And, you know, like the older, the better. And I was especially interested in butterflies from the introduced range. So areas where it seems like monarchs had recently become established. And so, yeah, what started at the University of Guam then became like, okay, I'll also check what's in the collection at UC Davis, which is where I was doing my PhD. And then it was like, well, you know, UC Berkeley is pretty close by. I should, you know, go see what they have. And this was all kind of early in grad school. And I was getting some, you know, hints from the data that there might be interesting patterns going on. But like a lot of these collections would only have, you know, 5 or 6 Pacific Island butterflies. And so at some point I decided like, you know what, I'm going to dive in headfirst. And that's when I started going to like the American Museum of Natural History, the Smithsonian, like some of these bigger collections that have thousands and thousands of monarch butterflies as part of their holdings, including some from these really far flung locations. And that's where, this project became like kind of an obsession.
Yeah, I mean, in the end, you photographed more than 6,000 butterflies, I think, and measured the wings of these butterflies, which is amazing. Did you do all this by yourself?
More or less. I had some help from a few undergrads, and Hugh also, who I mentioned earlier, he accompanied me to some of the collections. But yeah, the vast majority of the butterflies in this data set were ones that I photographed myself. There are also some museum collections or university collections that have been digitized. And those were always a delight for me to find, to see that someone else had already photographed them in a standardized way that I could measure.
Yeah, I bet that was nice. But nevertheless, you must have spent many, many hours in these insect collections or in these butterfly collections. So could you take us there? Could you explain to us what it looks like in a butterfly collection? How are the insects stored? How do you access them? What does it look like?
Sure. So insect collections, they tend to be, they all are somewhat similar. So they tend to be, they're always in like the back of their respective museums. And the specimens themselves are stored in drawers, which I think is kind of standard for natural history collections. but and they're in these things called like compactors. So it's oftentimes like floor to ceiling shelves that are just full of drawers, and they're arranged kind of taxonomically. You have to like turn this big knob on the end of the shelves to actually create a space that you can then walk down to access the drawers. And for butterflies and moths, the standard way that they are preserved is by pinning them and then spreading their wings. So there's something called sort of standard pinning position. And yeah, if you imagine sort of like the butterfly emoji on your phone, that is an example of a butterfly in standard pinning position.
I imagine it's also extremely delicate to work with these butterflies. I mean, these old specimens that may be from the 1800s, and then these tiny legs and antenna. Like, you know, when I work with bird skins, which is the museum work I do, I don't really have to worry about generally that a leg or a wing will fall off. But I imagine that that's a concern for insects, right?
In some cases, I think the oldest ones that I worked with were collected in the 1850s. And you can imagine they get like pretty brittle. And so like, yeah, I felt like I was holding my breath handling them.
Yeah, I can imagine. But after all that hard work, you had this really nice data set now of thousands of butterflies, photographs of thousands of butterflies that came from different populations that had, well, both from populations that migrated and populations that had lost the ability to migrate. And the next thing you did was measuring some traits on these images, on these butterflies, and you were particularly interested in wing shape and wing size. So could you tell us why these two traits are particularly important to understand migration?
Yeah, so like we talked about earlier when we were discussing monarch migration, in order for them to make this spectacular thousands of kilometers journey to the overwintering sites in Mexico, you can imagine like that journey is a gauntlet, and they need all sorts of sort of special physiology and then also morphology in order to make it. And in terms of their morphology and completing that very long migration, the sort of general rule of thumb is that bigger is better. So larger butterflies tend to also have larger wings. And that's important because when they're flying, those larger wings allow for them to generate more lift when they're flapping. And then also when they're gliding, it gives them more surface area. So the sort of process of flight, we think, is likely more efficient for butterflies that have larger wings. The shape of the wing is also thought to be important. And, you know, partly from people who study birds, but then also from butterflies and bats, we know that, particular wing shapes can be helpful for long distance flights. And yeah, we tend to think of wing tips that are sort of narrow and pointed at the tip. Those can help to reduce like vortices that develop at the in sort of the air current that they're flying in, and those vortices can create drag that slow them down. And so having these sort of pointed tipped wings reduces that drag and can make the process more efficient. And so, kind of all of this is to say, we had an idea that migratory butterflies would have both large wings and also wings that were pointed at the tip. And we know from a couple lines of evidence that that is associated with higher migration success. And then, yeah, we wanted to contrast those wings with these butterflies that no longer have to pass through this seasonal gauntlet of long distance migration to see what removing that selection pressure does to their wings.
Right. So now you had this really amazing data set that you could test these questions on. And we should add that this data set did not only include the butterflies in Guam and that population, but multiple different populations where monarchs had lost their migrational ability. So that's different Pacific islands, but also islands in the Atlantic and some places in South America as well. as well as, of course, including the North American migrational population, and you could compare the two groups. So when you compared wing shape and wing size through time and between migratory and non-migratory butterflies, what did you find?
Yeah, there are a couple of findings, but one of the things that we found was butterflies from populations that no longer migrate do, in fact, have both smaller wings in terms of their wing area, and they also tend to be less elongated. So the tip of the wing is sort of more blunt or rounded as opposed to being kind of angular and pointed. That pattern is especially true if you contrast North American butterflies with the southward range expansion into Central America and the Caribbean and South America. And we think the reason for that is that that expansion event probably happened more distantly. So my best guess is that that happened on the order of like tens of thousands of years ago. And so those non-migratory populations have had a long time in isolation, and that's where you get the most pronounced differences in morphology, like the smallest and sort of least migratory looking butterflies. The butterflies in the Atlantic and the Pacific are much more contemporary losses of migration. So those coincide with relatively recent range expansion events, like over the last 150 years or so. And so in those populations, we still can find differences. They are still smaller, and the wings are smaller and less elongated, but the differences aren't quite as pronounced. But the thing that is really cool about the Pacific and the Atlantic populations is you can use all of those museum specimens to actually look through time and see, like in real time, you can see that these butterflies have become smaller. So it's not just capturing like snapshots at the end point of some process. Like you can really see the process in action, which is kind of incredible.
Yeah, I think that's really quite unique, because a lot of times as evolutionary biologists, what we try to do is reconstructing what happened in the past using the evidence of the present. So it's a little bit like detective work, really. But what you could do is having this nice time series where you could actually follow the changes over time, which is really cool. And another thing that you could ask with that data set is, what did those first founding individuals look like, the first butterflies that founded these populations in the Pacific Islands and the Atlantic and so on? Were they different than your average North American migrational butterfly?
Yeah, so that was one of the predictions that we could test with this data set. And it does, it is largely true that the individuals that first became established in these locations, they're not just average North American butterflies. They actually tend to be drawn from kind of the tails of the distribution in terms of their traits that we think are associated with their flight ability. So their wings are sort of extra large or extra elongated. And probably we think the reason why that's the case is like those butterflies had to traverse huge expanses of open ocean to get there in the first place. And so they're sort of, yeah, passing through this selective filter. For some of these Pacific and Atlantic locations, it does look like that is the case. We're a little bit limited because we don't usually have huge sample sizes from early on in the establishment process. And we also don't know precisely when they got there. So we're kind of assuming that the first record that we see roughly coincides with their arrival time there. But one really neat thing that we can look at, and it's kind of the exception that proves the rule, is every so often, monarch butterflies will show up in Great Britain, of all places, like in the UK, and the records of them there tend to coincide with also records of North American migratory birds that are kind of off track. We think they probably get just blown over during storms, but unlike these Pacific and Pacific Islands where the monarchs became established, there's nothing for monarchs to eat in the UK. And so there are about 20 museum collected monarchs from the UK in museum collections. And those ones are actually really informative because they can tell us about what a true first generation arrival would look like. We know those butterflies didn't develop there locally, and they really, they're vagrants, off course migrants that just happened to show up there. And there you see the pattern especially strongly. Those butterflies are really big and really elongated.
Right. So it's the idea that these populations that got to the Pacific and Atlantic islands and so on, did they also likely just get blown over, or was it like some butterflies that just had, they got the directions wrong and instead of flying to Mexico, they flew over to a nice Pacific island? Or
that's still kind of an open question is, how did the first monarch butterfly get to Hawaii, for example? It would have to traverse a huge stretch of open ocean. And I would say, we don't know for sure. There are some records, like sailors' logs of, people being out at sea, like hundreds of kilometers from the nearest landmass, and they will report butterflies at sea, like just flying with nothing on the horizon. And they will sometimes land on the rigging of those ships. And so there's some speculation that it was potentially human aided, the first individuals that arrived. It might have been, they might have hitched a ride. But there are other instances where we know that the expansion or the establishment was almost certainly a natural process. And one of the sort of really fun stories here is that in Australia, there were basically up until 1871, no one had ever collected a monarch butterfly in Australia. And then all of a sudden, within the span of a few months, a bunch of people independently started to collect them. And the sort of speculation on what happened was that there was a cyclone that passed over New Caledonia, where we know that there were records of monarch butterflies at the time. That cyclone then traversed, passed into Australia. And the thought is that monarchs were sort of carried by the winds of this storm. And that's the explanation for why almost simultaneously a bunch of people started to record them there.
A cyclone of monarchs, that truly would be a sight. But I guess it's interesting to think that they can just be blown over to these islands, and then, once they're there, maybe they lose their migrational ability because they no longer need to migrate. But then that leads me to my next question, which is, once they have established these non-migratory populations, are they kind of stuck? Because at that point, they've lost the traits that would allow them to travel further again. So are they kind of stuck evolutionarily in the sense that they can never evolve these migratory abilities again?
Yeah, so that's a really fantastic question. And I think that's one of the sort of big open research areas that is still sort of really ripe for future research in this system. So I would say we don't really know the answer, but it's, I think it's definitely possible that even after these butterflies have stopped migrating, even for hundreds or thousands of generations, part of the reason why they're not migrating is just that they're not getting the right environmental cues that tell them it's time to migrate. And if you were to expose them to the relevant seasonal cues again, it's possible that they would develop like a migrant normally would. And we just don't know the answer to that question. That's one of the things that I'm working on here at the University of Chicago that I'm really excited to learn more about. The other clue that we have is that monarch butterflies in Australia seem to have evolved potentially kind of we call it secondary migration. So even though the butterflies in Australia, we know that they're mostly non-migratory, and they're derived from a non-migratory ancestor population. But there are parts of Australia where they definitely do seasonal movements that look like what you see in parts of North America. So, and there are, yeah, people have tagged butterflies in Australia and recorded flights of up to about 400 kilometers. So they are still carrying out some seasonal movements when they reestablish in places that have strongly seasonal environments. So yeah, it seems like the migration probably isn't completely lost, but yeah, we don't really know.
That's really interesting. So it's almost like some kind of dormant migrant trait that these butterflies carry, right? Which would allow them presumably to adapt much faster to an environment where they needed to move. Maybe then some other, you know, if you just took a random butterfly that has never been migrational, then doesn't have this kind of history of genes. Which leads me on to our next topic, which is the future of monarch butterflies. So monarch populations are declining in many places. They face a lot of different kinds of threats, including climate change and habitat destruction and, you know, the protection of their roosting sites in Mexico and so on. So people are worried about, well, in part the species, but also their migrational patterns, that this will change in the future. So I guess my first question for you is, did you find in your data of the North American butterflies that they've changed in wing shape and size through time from, well, the early 1800s up to the present day?
Yeah, so that, I guess that was one of the surprising patterns that came out of the data, was in, when we look at time series of North American butterflies, this was sort of, you know, just like our comparison population where we didn't necessarily have strong expectations for a change through time. But we were kind of surprised to find that it seems like North American butterflies have actually become larger through time. And again, we're comparing across literally thousands of butterflies just within our North American sample. And so, to say that they've become significantly larger actually equates to a relatively small absolute difference. I guess you can say that, you know, if you compare a North American butterfly from 1870 with one now, they are on average about 4 to 5% larger than they were back then. We don't know exactly why that might be the case, but there are a lot of sort of potential reasons. I think one of the ones that is maybe compelling is the idea of that potentially their breeding range has shifted slightly, and that they're having to migrate further to actually reach the overwintering site. And so that selective filter has become kind of even more intense over the last 150 years or so. That's, we don't know that for sure, but that's one possible explanation.
That's really interesting. And do you feel like this has implications for the conservation of monarch butterflies today?
Yeah, I guess there are, I didn't set out doing this research specifically to inform conservation practice, so I should say that from the outset, but I do think there are a few like lessons that can be learned from this research. One of them is that monarch butterflies are adaptable. We can see that even over relatively contemporary time periods that there have been these noticeable changes in their morphology. And so, I would say they're not just like helpless actors. There's a ton of genetic variation out there in monarch butterflies, and it's, as overwhelming as it can be to think about all of the threats that they face, they also are quite resilient. The other thing that I think some of this research is potentially informative for is kind of thinking about, I don't think there's a future where monarch butterflies are ever going to go extinct, but it's their migration within North America that is really kind of the spectacle that is, deeply associated with the species and what is like truly evolutionarily special about the monarch butterfly. And that's kind of what's at threat. And these non-migratory populations are interesting because, you know, potentially they provide a window into what a future without migration looks like for monarch butterflies. And they can also be informative for thinking about, you know, in a situation where monarch butterfly numbers decline really precipitously, it then sort of begs the question, you know, like, is a butterfly from Hawaii that hasn't migrated for 1,000 generations, is it an adequate stand-in? Like, could you reintroduce an Australian butterfly to North America and would it behave like its migratory ancestors did?
Yeah, I mean, that's a situation I hope we won't find ourselves in, where we have to actually reintroduce monarchs from other populations and perhaps in the process losing this incredible migrational adaptation that they have. Because really, like you pointed out, it's not necessarily that the monarch as a species is about to go extinct, but perhaps this spectacle, this migrational adaptation is
yeah, they're still monarchs and they're, you know, still doing their thing, still eating milkweed, still mating, going about their monarch ways, but they're just, yeah, they're missing this like huge piece of their biology that has become so intimately associated with them.
Yeah, and it also highlights how it's important that we still collect monarchs and add to the time series that we have so that we can really study how and if monarchs are changing in the future as well.
Yeah, for sure. And that's like, I whenever I go to some of these locations to work with monarchs, I will usually collect a few to pin and contribute to museum collections. And it feels like this very like small act of like giving back. And that's, it's fun to think about yourself as like being a part of this like unbroken line of people who have made these collections dating back literally hundreds of years. And it's, you know, that's one of the things that I think is exciting and, you know, like gives me goosebumps is just the idea that like people made these collections having no idea that I would show up 150 years later to measure them. And it's really fun to think about what someone in the future might do with these very same collections.
Absolutely. And that's a very inspiring note to end on. So I think with that, I'll thank you so much, Micah, for taking the time to talk to me today about monarchs. It's been so fascinating and I've learned a bunch that I didn't know before. So thank you so much.
Yeah. I had fun talking about them too.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Specimen Stories. If you want to know where monarchs are right now, you can find a live map of their migration at journeynorth.org, a program which allows citizen scientists to report sightings of migrating animals. And if you're curious about Micah's research or want to learn more about monarch migrations, go to the show website at claranorden.com/specimenstories. This episode was recorded and produced by me, Clara Nordén, and the music was downloaded from purpleplanet.com and pixabay.com. If you like the show or have any thoughts or comments you'd like to share with me, let me know at specimenstoriespodcast@gmail.com. Until next time, goodbye.